You are listening to 90.1 FM, KKFI, Kansas City Community Radio.
It's Monday morning. My name is Keith Brownhill. Welcome to Jaws of Justice Radio. On today's edition, host Jessica Thomas talks with George Lombardi, director of the Missouri Department of Corrections, about puppies for parole. Then in the second half of the show, host Margot Patterson talks with Josh Rubner about his new book, Shattered Hopes, Obama's Failure to Broker Israeli-Palestine Peace. Get your pens and paper ready for our calendar of events in the middle of the show. And as always, the 420 drug war news after the show. And now here's Jessica and Director Lombardi.
So good morning, George Lombardi. Thank you for joining me. And our program that we're talking about this morning on Jaws of Justice is Pups for Parole. You have brought in animals into the corrections system. Whose idea was this to start this?
Well, let me go back into history a little bit. About 11 years ago or so, when I was director of the prisons before I retired in 2005, I was approached by an organization out of St. Louis called Champs Incorporated, and that organization trains dogs for the disabled. And they asked if we would consider allowing the women at our prison in Vandalia to do a good portion of that training. And while I was aware that there were other states that had dog programs of some sort, we were all a little skeptical about getting it started. But after a period of time, we did begin it there. And it's been a wonderful program, still in existence. And the women have trained some 60 dogs for disabled folks. And, you know, and that takes from 12 to 18 months to train a dog appropriately. So they've really made a tremendous accomplishment for people in need, people in wheelchairs, people that are disabled. And then I retired in 2005, but when the governor asked me to come back as a cabinet member, as director of corrections in 2009, I approached all the wardens because what I had seen with the program in Vandalia was that not only was it a great program for the dogs and for Champs, but it also had a really positive impact on the culture of the prison and on the behavior of the offenders, et cetera. And I just felt like it was an overall excellent approach to rehabilitation. And so I approached the wardens when I came back, all the wardens, all 20 wardens, and said, look, here's what I think we should do. This was during a time, this was 2009, and this is 10 rather, and this was a time when the state of Missouri in particular was getting headlines about puppy mills in particular and all the problems we have in this state in regard to that. And I knew that the shelters around the state were overrun with those dogs. And so I said, here's an opportunity for you as warden and your facility to develop a relationship with your local dog shelter to take in some of those dogs, train them accordingly, and perhaps make them adoptable and interdict the euthanizing of those dogs, or either that or if it was a no-kill shelter, living the rest of their lives in a cage. And I said, I know it's going to have a positive impact on the atmosphere of your prison and especially on the dog handlers who will be involved with this. The person that stepped up to do this was the warden of the Jeff City Correctional Center, which is the replacement of maximum security prison for the old MSP. And Dave Dormeyer, who is now our director of all the prisons, said, I want to do it. And when our senior warden, he'd been warden for 18 years, and when the senior warden like Dave was willing to take the chance on doing that, it seemed like it was okay for the rest of them to do that. And one by one by one, over the last 3 years, each facility has come online, and now we have 19 out of our 20 prisons that are involved with the Puppies for Parole and have this program available in the facilities and working with local shelters.
How do you determine who gets into the program?
Well, that's determined by the casework staff and the wardens making decision about who should be involved in it. Obviously, they have to have a good record. We're not going to have anybody that's got animal abuse in their background, as example. But other than that, you know, we leave that up to the local folks, and it's worked out just fine as who they've chosen to do this.
Does it seem to run throughout all of the areas, as opposed to somebody who was in a short time or someone who's in for a longer period of time?
Since 19 out of our 20 prisons are involved, every level of security is involved, from maximum security down to medium and minimum security. Oh. They're all involved. So every type of offender in terms of the time left to serve, including those that have no parole status, are involved in the program. So since the time of the first dog walked into the facility at Jeff City Correctional Center on February 1st, 2010, I just got a figure of the number of dogs who have been trained, socialized, passed the American Kennel Club good citizenship test, and adopted out. The total is now 2,216 dogs.
That's an amazing number.
It is amazing. We've got the largest program in the United States by far.
And obvious reasons, it's great for the animals who are given a stay of execution, are rehomed, and they're doing great service. What, if any, records are you guys keeping or being able to see the trends with the prisoners, how this affects them?
Actually, we have a study being done by Dr. Rebecca Johnson of the University of Missouri, who happens to be an international expert on human-animal interaction, who has done a pre- and post-study on four of our facilities, the last four that have come online, and we're waiting to see the results of that in terms of the behavior of the inmates and as well as staff attitudes and so forth. And, you know, the preliminary information shows us that the need for mental health contact, the need for infirmary contact has all dropped with those that have been involved in the program. So it's been really a very positive outcome. It's been a win-win-win situation. There is no doubt about it. And the thing about, to get into things a little bit deeper, one of the things that I've learned, you know, this is like my 39th year in the correction system, and one of the things I've learned is that a lot of our offenders either lack compassion and altruism, either because they never had it to begin with or it was suppressed because of childhood trauma. And the thing about dogs is they bring out that emotion, and which is very, very positive, and it helps them psychologically, emotionally, cognitively. And that's the kind of impact we want to see. And if you talk to any warden who may have been skeptical to begin with to start this program, now that it's been in operation in their facility, they would never let it go.
It seems that, you know, because animals are very benevolent, they bring in a whole new energy to any situation, especially a situation that's as tense as being incarcerated. There are so many, you know, issues there. We're having almost a confidant, you know, in residing. Do the animals reside 24 hours a day with their trainer?
Yes. There's actually two trainers because the facilities are double-celled. So you have two trainers and then a dog in his crate. And, yes, it is a 24-hour responsibility. They are responsible for all the training and related to it. Now, we're very, very fortunate in that in each one of our facilities, we have excellent civilian trainers that come in, and we also have staff that are willing to step up and help to coordinate that program. One of the things I did when I started this program was to say, look, we're not going to do this. We're going to do this with absolutely zero tax dollars, and we have. And there have been many donations that we've had. We're very, very fortunate in regard to that. And we have staff that have full-time jobs otherwise that are willing to step up and assist with this as well, and then the civilian people as well. So we've been very, very fortunate that way.
So when an animal requests to go out, so are they, like, paper-trained in the cell then? So they're...
No, actually, they train the dogs to be housebroken, and they are able to take them outside, and we do have a fenced-in area, especially for the dogs to go out and run and play, and they're allowed to do that. But in short order, the dogs are housebroken, and they generally sleep through the night, and it's never really a problem. But if there is one, then the officers in the dormitory understand that that has to be accommodated, and they do.
Awesome. And that does allow your residents to have some feeling of, you know, empowerment as well with their animals. They grow in trust with the staff as well.
It's been a real excellent atmosphere to set up a good relationship between staff and offenders as well. And the interesting thing that's happened that I hadn't foreseen, I mean, there's been many, many positive things I hadn't foreseen, but the one that really got to me is that over half the dogs have been adopted by the staff of the prison.
That is kind of an unforeseen thing.
Yeah.
Well, you're training these animals then to be assistants to, service dogs.
No.
No.
These are simply shelter dogs that we're training to be obedient, socialized, and wonderful family pets for the most part.
Oh, cool.
Yeah.
Yeah.
This is not a, you know, we couldn't do 2,216 service dogs.
Right.
There's no way.
I was going to say, that's pretty impressive.
No. This usually takes from like 8 to 12 weeks,
uh-huh.
And then you know they're. And keep in mind that we take some of the dogs that are very, very difficult to be adopted out. That's why the shelters turn to our offenders to help them train dogs that are difficult. They're not aggressive usually, because we can't have that in the prison. But they may. A lot of the dogs are carried in because they're so scared been abused, neglected, et cetera. And the guys really can relate to that and turn those dogs into wonderful pets. In addition, we've taken dogs that are deaf, dogs that are blind, and in fact have had a number of dogs that were deaf and blind that the guys have done a wonderful job with, and the ladies, and turned them into great pets.
So this began in the women's prison?
Well, the program I mentioned to you was the service dog program at the prison in Vandalia many years ago.
Mm-hmm.
But, of course, Chillicothe is our other women's prison, and they have a Puppies for Parole program, just like all the male facilities.
It's a wonderful service, and these animals probably, you know, wouldn't get homes otherwise.
You're right. These are the dogs that are usually going to get euthanized in kill shelters or live their life in a cage in a no-kill shelter because they've got a lot of issues and they're generally not adoptable.
Does it almost seem like a parallel with a resident of or a prisoner that how lives will run very parallel? Treatment coming up in life kind of sets them on a path, and then these animals are allowed redemption. And they're able to find new homes and things. Do you hope that, or do you see that happening?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. Uh-huh. It's the same thing. It's the issue I mentioned about compassion. You know, the dogs don't care what you did or who you are. They love you. And so keeping in mind that showing affection in a prison is obviously taboo, but you can do it with a dog and bring back those kinds of feelings inside of you that have been locked up for maybe a number of years. It's a very powerful impact on the offenders that are involved, but it also affects the entire campus of the prisons for everybody. So it's been really, really terrific.
Do you see a breed, more often than others that come through because of the stigma that's attached to
them? A lot of labs, and that's just because it's a very popular breed. One of the things that's a phenomena, and everybody knows this, that black dogs are hard to get adopted.
Huh.
And that's a phenomena that's, everybody is aware of that. So we do get a lot like that, but we get a lot of mixed breeds.
Uh-huh.
They're mostly mutts, but we have some actual, full-bred dogs of every kind, from Chihuahuas, to Labradors, to Golden Retrievers, to Beagles, and so forth. It's the whole thing. Because the issue is that a lot of these dogs have been abused and neglected, and so they may have been purchased as a purebred dog, but then they were treated poorly.
Wow. Interesting. Do prisoners, do they keep up with the animals? Do they know where they go?
Yeah, they're aware of where they go, and we leave it up to the doctor as to whether they want to come back, not come back, but share with us how things are going, and they do frequently.
Mm-hmm. I bet they do.
Yeah. Keep in mind, a lot of guys have had a lot of dogs.
Yeah.
So, in other words, if you've done well with a dog, and, you know, it's very, and obviously it is hard for them to turn it loose, but they understand that if they've done well with a dog, they'll get another one.
Right.
And so that's the way it works. And we have, in many facilities, we have graduation ceremonies where the dogs graduate, and some of the owners will come in and they'll have the exchange of the leash, where the inmate takes the leash off that he's used with the dog, and the new owner puts their leash on, and there's this transference of the dog between the handler and the owner.
But it's really got to be kind of an emotional moment
for
everybody.
It is. It's a very, very emotionally powerful time. And usually at graduation ceremonies, one of the offenders will be picked to say what it meant to them to be involved in the program, and we have some very, very powerful speeches by a lot of the offenders accordingly.
So have you seen it change the lives of the prisoners outside? Has anybody gone on from handling dogs and then gone into maybe training or back to school for veterinary or
Well, yeah, we've had people that have gone on to Petco, and we've worked hard to get a Department of Labor actual certificate for offenders who work hard at doing this and go through the all the requirements to get a certificate, and so they can go out the door with that piece.
That's really fantastic work.
Yeah, it's been great.
Yeah, I could imagine. How do you work the vet care then? Do you have an outside veterinarian that comes in, or is there
services? The dogs belong to the shelter right up to and including adoption. We don't do the adoption. The shelters do. So the veterinary care is the responsibility of the shelter where the dog came from.
You know, and it's kind of interesting because on either end, nobody, really either party has nothing to lose by trusting each other. And so it's really a great combination, a great matching of situations for not just the animal who is getting a reprieve from death, but then the prisoner who's given a different way of looking at things and really someone to love.
Right. It changes people that are involved in it. There's no question about it. And that's why I say it's a win-win-win. You know, it helps the individual. It helps the atmosphere of the prison. It helps with relationships between staff and offenders. Obviously, it saves the dog. It helps the shelter. The person who adopts the dog gets a wonderful pet that's obedient and socialized, and, you know, they talk about that all the time. And, we now have a Facebook page that has wonderful stories. If you go on our website at doc.mo.gov, you can click on Puppies for Parole, and you can see all kinds of stories, videos, and a listing and picture of all the dogs we have in-house presently. And today we have 144 dogs in-house. I actually did a survey of my colleagues, the other directors of corrections, and asked them if they would be interested in having a national conference on correctional dog programs, and had very positive response, so we're working at that possibility. I will also tell you that we've gotten a lot of national and international coverage of this issue, and there's a rehome place in England called Battersea, and Battersea is a huge shelter system. I think they have some 300 employees, and they're in like three or four different places. It's the patron of Battersea is none other than Her Majesty the Queen. In any event, they searched around the country for a program to try to emulate to approach Her Majesty's penitentiaries about doing something similar, and they chose us, and their executive director is going to come visit us.
That's pretty incredible. So that's happening soon?
We hope, but maybe in May.
Oh, that really would be something.
Yes.
Any story at all that sticks out in your mind?
Oh, my. There are many, many stories. There are many, many stories. If you go on our Facebook and on our website, you can see many of them. But we have a next step.
Uh-huh.
A next step is that we are partnering with Comtree Community Health out of Jefferson County. And with them, we are going to take some of the dogs to a higher level. And that is, yes, service dogs, but more than that. We're going to train dogs to be courtroom dogs for children who have to testify about sex abuse.
Uh-huh.
We're training dogs for nursing homes, veterans homes, and for hospices, potentially.
Mm-hmm.
So one of the ways we've done that is through the Department of Mental Health, in particular with Judy Finnegan, who is Vice President of Comtree at Over Human-Animal Interaction. She actually nominated us back in 2010 for the Governor's Award for Innovation, which we did receive from the governor.
Awesome.
And has helped us develop this advanced program and hooked us up with the veterans homes, where almost every one of our veterans homes in the state of Missouri now has one of our puppies for parole dogs. Eight of the mental health facilities in the state have one of our dogs, all making an impact on the residents tremendously. We have some of our nursing homes now that are adopting our dogs, also making tremendous impact on the residents as well, and really sparking their life better than what that's ever been before. So that's the way we want to go. In addition to the normal saving dogs from being euthanized, we'd like to take some of our dogs into places like that to make a difference in the lives and help people. We've got a dog that was just adopted by Comtree, who have purchased a farm in Hillsboro called Bridle Ridge Acres, where they're doing human-animal interaction with horses and dogs. And that dog is really playing a part to help the adolescent residential treatment center that they have, helping the kids there adjust and making a difference with them. So that's kind of where we want to go.
Every day.
Yeah, you know, we see that. And if you go on our site, you'll see a story about Karma,
uh-huh,
who is an amazing, amazing dog. If you, you know, go on our site, we're on Bridle Ridge Acres,
uh-huh,
and you will see the story of Karma, who is making quite an impact with the young boys.
I appreciate you joining us, George.
Well, thank you. Thank you for the opportunity. I always enjoy talking about it because it's such a positive and uplifting issue and very meaningful to everybody involved, including me.
Now, maybe our society will change just a little bit more compassion. It really goes a long way.
Absolutely. I believe that that's a critical component.
Okay. Thank you so much, George.
And now, the Jaws of Justice radio calendar for March 3rd, 2014. The monthly meeting of the Criminal Justice Task Force will be today, Monday, March 3rd, from 6:45 to 8:45 p.m. at the Church of the Good Shepherd, 4947 Sholto Drive, KCMO. They are asking that you bring non-perishable food items or canned goods for the Good Shepherd Backpack Program that provides food for needy school children. For more information, call Robin at 816-468-7894. Billy Moore, who spent time on death row in Georgia and whose sentence was commuted to life after the victim's family members advocated for him not to be executed, will be the speaker at the Missourians for Alternatives to the Death Penalty meeting at 6:30 p.m. Tuesday, March 4th at All Souls Unitarian Universalist Church, 4501 Walnut, KCMO. The Kansas City chapter of Missouri Association for Social Welfare's First Friday Forum will be Friday, March 7th, 11:30 a.m. to 1 p.m. at the Westport Flea Market, 817 Westport Road, KCMO. This month's forum will be an examination of the death penalty, which State Senator Jody Justice and Don McLean of Missourians for Alternatives to the Death Penalty. A showing of the documentary Mama C, Urban Warrior in the African Bush, followed by a discussion with Charlotte Mama C. O'Neill, who is visiting from Tanzania, will be Saturday, March 8th, from 7 o'clock p.m. to 9 o'clock p.m. at the All Souls Unitarian Church, 4501 Walnut Street, Kansas City, Missouri. Children in the fifth grade and above are welcome and should be accompanied by an adult. My name is Keith Brown-Earl, reminding you that these events and more can be found on the Jaws of Justice Radio Facebook page, as well as the Jaws of Justice Radio page on the KKFI website, kkfi.org.
And we have one more calendar item to add in here. The KC Substance Abuse Treatment and Recovery Support Coalition and Access to Recovery 3 meeting will be Thursday, March 6th at the Salvation Army Adult Rehabilitation Center, room 106. They are located at 1351 East 10th Street, KCMO. They will be assigning committees and working on grant proposals. If your organization is providing recovery services and you want to find out more, contact Liddell Flowers at 816-531-6050 or email l_flowers@dismashousekc.com. And now to Margot and her guest, Josh Rudner.
Josh Rudner is National Advocacy Director of the Washington nonprofit, the U.S. Campaign to End the Israeli Occupation, and author of the new book, Shattered Hopes, Obama's Failure to Broker Israeli-Palestinian Peace. Before we begin talking about your book, Josh, maybe you could tell us a little bit about how you became interested in the Israeli-Palestinian conflict and how you came to work on it.
Sure. Thanks so much for having me on your program, Margot. My father was born in what was then the British Mandate of Palestine in 1944, which became Israel in 1948, and he became an Israeli citizen, lived there in his childhood, and immigrated to this country, so that I have long-standing familial ties to this issue. And ever since I've had any political awareness and consciousness of Israel's policies toward the Palestinian people, I've been very dismayed and distraught by those oppressive policies, and believe that as somebody who has this both Israeli heritage and U.S. citizenship being born in this country, I have a dual obligation to end Israel's oppressive policies toward the Palestinian people, because whereas it's Israel that is directly oppressing the Palestinian people, it is our economic and military and diplomatic support for Israel which underwrites and makes possible this oppression.
Well, obviously, as National Advocacy Director for the Campaign to End the Israeli Occupation, you're engaged with this issue every day. Was there anything in particular that led you to write this book about Barack Obama and his failure to broker peace between Israelis and Palestinians?
Right. My book details Obama's policies during his first term in office, and I decided to write this book largely due to the fact that there were two massive leaks of official documents from this period that really enabled the researcher to get unprecedented access to the behind-the-scenes goings-on of the administration. And oftentimes, historians have to wait 20, 30, 40 years for the archives of an administration to open to get access to these documents. And, of course, I'm talking about WikiLeaks as one source. And the other source is known as the Palestine Papers, which was thousands of documents that were leaked from within the Palestinian negotiating team by a disgruntled employee of the Palestinian negotiating team to Al Jazeera in 2011. And between these two sets of documents, you can really get an insider's account, almost as if you're a fly on the wall in the negotiations and in the diplomatic goings-on. So this is why I wrote the book, because really we have have unprecedented access to contemporary accounts of what actually took place.
What did you discover in these leaked documents that most surprised you?
I would say the great lengths to which the United States went to protect Israel diplomatically during Obama's first term. So, for example, in WikiLeaks, you can see quite clearly how the Obama administration conspired with Israel to prevent Israel from being held accountable for the war crimes that it committed, which were documented by what was known as the Goldstone Report. The Goldstone Report was a 575-page exhaustive report by the UN Human Rights Council, which documented the fact that Israel and Palestinian armed groups, for that matter, committed human rights abuses, violations of international law, war crimes, and possible crimes against humanity during Israel's attack on the Gaza Strip in December 08, January 09. And through WikiLeaks, you can see how the United States used its diplomatic leverage to kill the Goldstone Report and to make sure that Israel was not held accountable for these war crimes because of our diplomatic support for it in the international arena.
In your book, you talk about Barack Obama coming into the White House being perhaps the best educated American president about the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, and how he came in really with the resolution to try to settle this. Why then did he go to such great lengths to protect Israel from the consequences of the Goldstone Report?
Well, I think very early on in his first term, Obama was quite insistent that Israel had to stop its colonization of Palestinian land if there were to be any hope of having a successful, quote, peace process. But what he experienced very early on in his administration was a huge amount of pushback from the Israel lobby, from the forces that keep our policy enthralled to Israel's interests. And quite frankly, he wasn't prepared for the pushback, and he chose not to fight it. And confronted with this pressure from the Israel lobby, he basically capitulated to it. And what he did was he appointed a fellow by the name of Dennis Ross to be on his National Security Council and to be, in his words, his, quote, quarterback on all Middle East issues. Now, Dennis Ross is someone who comes directly from the Israel lobby. And during the Bush administration and the Clinton administration, Ross was a key figure in the U.S. managing of the peace process. And before he was a government employee, he worked for the American-Israel Public Affairs Committee, the largest and most important component of the Israel lobby. So what you have is a situation of Obama reverting very quickly to the status quo ante in terms of his policies, which is why he was not able to make any progress, and which is why I'm convinced that John Kerry's current efforts will be for naught as well.
Well, the title of your book is, you know, Shattered Hopes. I think many Americans reading the headlines think, well, maybe something is going to happen. The Palestinians and Israelis are talking again. Secretary of State Kerry seems intent on single-handedly rejuvenating the peace process. Should our hopes really be as shattered as your book title suggests?
Well, it's true that right now the United States is engaged in the most intensive and comprehensive set of negotiations between Israelis and Palestinians that have really taken place since the Clinton administration. But quantity does not equal quality. The fact that these negotiations have been going on since late July does not mean that there's been any progress toward resolving the key issues that lay at the crux of the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. And in fact, one of the senior Palestinian negotiators, a fellow by the name of Yasser Abd Rabu, has come out and said that these are the worst negotiations that he's been a part of in 20 years. He's called them fruitless. He's called them meaningless. And the reason why they're fruitless and meaningless is because what Israel's proposing, backed by the United States, is that in any, quote, peace deal, it will keep and retain and annex all of its major settlement blocks. Jerusalem will remain the, quote, eternal undivided capital of Israel with no Palestinian political presence in what they consider to be Jerusalem. There will be no right of return for Palestinian refugees who were exiled from their homes and ethnically cleansed by Israel upon its establishment in 1948. And Israel is now demanding that Palestinians accept not the existence of Israel, but the existence of Israel as a Jewish state, meaning that they would be forced to recognize a situation in which the 20% of Israelis who are actually Palestinian and who have Israeli citizenship would be relegated to a permanent Jim Crow-like second-class status.
So are these worse terms than the previous round of negotiations we're dealing with?
I mean, all the ideas that are on the table right now are basically recycled and warmed over proposals from the Clinton era. It's the same ideas, and oftentimes it's the same people in the different U.S. administrations who are promoting these same ideas, and it's kind of like trying to hammer the square peg into the round hole. It doesn't fit, and it's not going to fit, no matter how many times you try, because all of these U.S. Proposals are premised on the idea that Palestinian rights should be relegated to Israel's desires for continued domination over the Palestinian people. And, of course, that cannot be the basis for a true, just, and lasting peace.
Well, in your opinion, is the U.S. then an obstacle to Mideast peace today? And I'm curious if you think it's always been.
Look, we provide Israel more than $3.1 billion in weapons every single year. Under international law, when you provide a party to a conflict with weapons, you've broken the laws of neutrality, and you've declared yourself to be on the side of the party that you are arming. So it's completely hypocritical and ridiculous for the United States to try to portray itself as an honest broker to this conflict when we're arming Israel to commit its terrible atrocities and human rights abuses against the Palestinian people. So at the very minimum, in order for us to truly be an honest broker, what we would have to do is end our military aid to Israel and end our diplomatic support for Israel, which prevents it from being held accountable for violating dozens and dozens of UN Security Council resolutions and its daily violations of the Fourth Geneva Convention in terms of its military occupation toward the Palestinians in the West Bank, East Jerusalem, and Gaza Strip.
You say in your book that as in previous rounds, or as previous administrations have also done, that the Obama administration has resisted the international community playing a bigger role in settling the conflict between Israelis and Palestinians. Tell us why the Obama administration, like it seems other administrations, is so resistant to that.
Because this is the way that Israel and the Israel lobby wants it. They understand that the United States is not an honest broker. They understand that it's the role of the United States to act as Israel's lawyers in these negotiations. And those are not my words, Israel's lawyers. Those are the words of a key former U.S. peace process official by the name of Aaron David Miller, who was heavily involved with these negotiations during the Clinton administration and during parts of the George W. Bush administration. And after he left government service in 2005, he wrote an op-ed in the Washington Post saying that we've acted as Israel's lawyers and we've catered to every Israeli whim at the expense of having successful negotiations. Now, this is the key peace process official admitting this. This is the role that the United States plays, and this is exactly the role that Israel and its lobby in the United States wants the United States to play. We're not an honest broker. When Obama came out in his first term and appointed the former Senate Majority Leader George Mitchell to be a special envoy for Middle East peace, Abe Foxman, who's the head of the Anti-Defamation League, one of the key organizations that are part of the Israel lobby, came out and condemned the president for daring to appoint someone who might pursue a policy of neutrality. This is not what Israel and its lobby wants. It wants us to remain engaged as Israel's lawyers, and this is why this, quote, peace process keeps on failing. It's because we have a client in this game. And it really is a game. It's a sham to provide a pretext for Israel's ongoing colonization of Palestinian land. And this is exactly the way that Israel and its supporters want it. And that's why the United States continually elbows out the UN, the EU, the Arab League, the Organization of Islamic Conference, etc., all of whom have a stake in the outcome as well.
Well, so the pro-Israel lobby especially AIPAC, the American-Israel Public Affairs Committee, obviously has a huge impact on this. How does it work that it can have such a big impact?
Well, as we are speaking right now, AIPAC is actually having its annual policy conference in Washington, D.C., and there are an estimated 14,000 attendees who are there to lobby for continued military aid to Israel and for U.S. war against Iran. It's a powerful lobby, and I think it works in a way that's really analogous to the gun lobby in this country. How can we have a situation where a mentally disturbed young person enters an elementary school in Connecticut and guns down 20 little school children, and 90% of people in this country want gun reform and more gun control, yet that's not even an option that's on the table in Washington, D.C. Is it because of the power and the clout of the gun lobby in determining the agenda for our policy in this country? And the role that the Israel lobby plays, I think, is very analogous to that.
This is Margot Patterson with Jaws of Justice Radio. If you're just tuning in, my guest today is Josh Rubner, National Advocacy Director of the Washington nonprofit, the U.S. Campaign to End the Israeli Occupation, and author of the book, Shattered Hopes, Obama's Failure to Broker Israeli-Palestinian Peace. Let's get back to talking about how the pro-Israel lobby works. Is it because it finances candidates? Is it because it is simply so vociferous and well-organized? What makes it such an effective lobbying organization?
It's a little bit of all of that and more. And it's also a function, I think, of electing pro-Israel officials and getting placed in key positions in the executive branch, individuals who are working to carry out this pro-Israel agenda. In addition to that, you have many, many bundlers of money who are motivated primarily by their attachment to this pro-Israel ideology and push for greater and greater U.S. support for Israel. So, I mean, it's a little bit of a mix of every type of effective lobbying that organizations do in this country, from the grassroots all the way up to the grass tops.
Well, it's clear in your book that Congress is even more captured by the pro-Israel lobby than the White House. Do you think most people in Congress, do they know the issues, but they are just subscribing to the pro-Israel lobby because that's in their interest? Or do you think there is a lot of ignorance on the part of our congressmen and women?
I think it's probably a mixture of both. I think towing the pro-Israel line is the path of least resistance. There's a lot to lose and almost nothing to gain by sticking one's neck out on Capitol Hill in support of Palestinian human rights, and that's because of the current political realities and current political calculus within our country. But that doesn't mean that people who are opposed to this very one-sided policy and who support the notion that we should be supporting the human rights and the self-determination of the Palestinian people, this doesn't mean that we should sit on the sidelines and do nothing. It's not an excuse for us not to contact and not to lobby our members of Congress, because if they don't hear from people who think differently, then that's going to reinforce this dynamic in their mind that no one out there cares. And people do care, and we're seeing that people are caring more and more through the proliferation of successes and victories through the BDS movement, boycott, divestment, and sanctions against Israel and corporations that profit from its human rights abuses against the Palestinians. And I think what we're going to see in the upcoming years is this sort of grassroots transformation that's taking place right now in terms of how Americans think and feel and act about this issue. I think we'll begin to see it trickle up to the policymakers.
Well, I want to ask you a few questions about BDS in just a moment, but if we talk about the American public in general, my perception is that many Americans tune out on this issue. You know, often there's not a lot of context to the reporting they read. They think, oh, there's two quarreling sides, a pox in both their houses. They're really just the same. What is it you would tell them about that point of view? That it's wrong, that it's, you know, there's a lot of truth to what they're thinking. What do you say?
Yeah, the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, for lack of a better word, and it's not really a conflict because conflict conjures up an image of two armies going at it. That's not at all the case here, where you have more of an apartheid situation of oppression and domination, one side versus another. But let's just call it Israeli-Palestinian conflict for simplicity's sake. Remind me where we were.
Oh.
I got sidetracked.
Oh, well, I was talking about the fact that I think many Americans just sort of tune out. They think, oh, the two sides are just the same. They're always quarreling.
Right.
You know, there's no difference between them.
Right. So what I would say to them is that although this conflict may be far off geographically, it is not at all far from what our responsibility is and what our complicity is in this situation. We are directly complicit in Israel's oppression of the Palestinian people because of our military aid, because of our diplomatic support, because we prevent the international community from imposing on Israel the requirements of a just and lasting peace, as they would do were it not for our diplomatic protection, this makes us complicit. When Israel fires a tear gas canister at a Palestinian who is exercising their right to freedom of expression and demonstration, oftentimes injuring or possibly even killing that person, that tear gas canister is made in the USA and paid for with our taxpayer dollars. Similarly, when Israel launches strikes against the Gaza Strip with Apache helicopter gunships or its F-16 fighter jets, and Sidewinder missiles and all of these things, all of these weapons are paid for by us as U.S. taxpayers, which makes us complicit in Israel's oppression of the Palestinian people. So if we don't want to be complicit in the suffering and oppression of another people, then we have an obligation to end this situation.
And, of course, I imagine that all plays a big role in, you know, for lack of a better word, the war on terror that is so often talked about. The Palestinians recently have sought to obtain member status in the United Nations, partly because it seems they sort of gave up on any chance of a U.S. brokered peace working out. Is that a hope? Does that strategy on their part, do you think, does that hold more hope for them?
I think it does, absolutely, and this is something that I detail in a chapter in my book, because it was a very, very significant move for Palestine to apply for membership in the United Nations back in 2011. And it set off alarm bells within Israel and pro-Israel advocacy groups in this country and amongst U.S. policymakers, for the simple reason that if Palestine is admitted as a full member of the UN, then they will have the power to join the ICC, the International Criminal Court. Now, the United States does not have veto power over what happens in the ICC. So if Palestine becomes a member of the ICC, they will then have a legal route open to them to try to advocate and advance their rights and hold Israel accountable for violating those rights that they don't have today. And Israel became incredibly concerned about the scenario of their defense minister or their prime minister or so on and so forth winding up in the same predicament as people like Slobodan Milosevic, hauled before the ICC and brought to justice that way. So Israel and the United States worked intensively to defeat Palestine from becoming a full member of the UN, which, of course, we can do as a country because we can veto that in the Security Council.
And why? What does the United States get out of always supporting Israel in this in the Security Council? I mean, why, given that Barack Obama seems like he sincerely would like to broker peace between Israelis and Palestinians, why does his administration oppose then the Palestinians gaining a role at the UN?
Because the United States believes that the only way that Palestinians should be able to exercise their political rights or their national self-determination is with the consent of Israel. Barack Obama very paternalistically lectured the Palestinians during his first term about how the time wasn't right and the fact that Palestine could only become a member of the UN with Israel's consent and as an outcome of a successful peace process. This is not at all the mentality that Martin Luther King Jr. had, you know, about waiting for others to grant you your rights. I mean, as he wrote in a letter from a Birmingham jail, he was tired of waiting on other people to tell him how he could or couldn't advance his rights. And here you have Barack Obama doing the exact same thing to the Palestinians, telling them that no, they can't advance their rights in the way that they see fit, but that approval had to be contingent on Israel's approval.
You say in the book that the Obama administration failed to develop a coherent strategy as regards peace between Israelis and Palestinians. Was that true of its approach to both sides or more to one side than another?
Well, I think that it's something that is reflective of a lot of the Obama administration's strategies toward various issues well beyond the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. But in the book, I quote Obama talking to his advisors saying, what's the strategy here? What's the next step? It was clear that it was a very helter-skelter policy.
Josh Rubner, thank you so much for talking to us. Josh Rubner, author of Shattered Hopes, Obama's Failure to Broker Israeli-Palestinian Peace.
Thank you.
Ready? One, two, three. What am I gonna do now? Am I gonna make it? Some way, somehow.
We hope you enjoyed today's show and that we leave you with something to think about, something to talk to your neighbors about, and a reason to get involved. As always, the opinions expressed are those of the hosts and guests of Jaws of Justice Radio, not of KKFI, the Midcoast Radio Project Incorporated, its staff, or volunteers. You can find our calendar of events or a link to our show episode and podcast on the Jaws of Justice Radio Facebook page. If you have a show idea or want to help produce the show, email us at jawsofjusticeradio@yahoo.com. And you can always listen to us live on the KKFI website at www.kkfi.org or at 90.1 FM. My name is Lee Moore, and we thank our engineer, Mike Murphy, host of the Wednesday Morning Buzz. Please tune in for the rest of our 9 a.m. weekday lineup with Law and Disorder on Tuesday, Alternative Radio on Wednesday, Tell Somebody with Tom Clammer on Thursday, and Between the Lines at 9 a.m. followed by Bioneers at 9:30 a.m. on Fridays. Up next is Beautician's Blues with Luscious Lynn, and at noon, the Arts Magazine with Michael Ho. Stick around for Jazz and Blues in the afternoon and Eco Radio KC at 6 p.m. Then round out your day with the spicy Latin sounds of Sabor Latino and Fiesta Musical. Make myself a better man.
It's the 420 Drug War News. The following from WHD-TV.
Has the nation's largest cocaine smuggler been revealed to be the Drug Enforcement Agency? Well, for decades, it's been rumored that the United States government was secretly sponsoring the smuggling of cocaine into the country. Federal officials have long denied such speculation, pointing out the billions of dollars spent intercepting drugs. Newly released documents and testimony from Justice Department and DEA officials now show the stories of government-running cocaine are in fact true. An investigation conducted in Mexico found the American government allowed that country's largest drug cartel, Sinaloa, to operate without fear of persecution. That group is estimated to be responsible for 80% of the cocaine coming into the United States through Chicago. In exchange, the leaders of Sinaloa provided the Drug Enforcement Agency in Washington, D.C. information on their rival gangs. The drug cartel working with the federal government is run by Joaquin El Capo Guzman. He is considered to be the world's most powerful drug trafficker. And in addition to Chicago, his group also maintains cocaine operations in several major cities around the nation. Written statements were provided to a U.S. district court in Chicago confirming the alliance between the DEA and Mexico's largest cocaine cartel. The written testimony, combined with other evidence, shows the Drug Enforcement Agency officials met with leaders of the Sinaloa cartel more than 50 times between 2000 and 2012. This would mean DEA-authorized drug smuggling goes back to at least the beginning of the George W. Bush administration and continued for a year under Barack Obama. One of the group's leaders, Vicente Zambada Nivella, claims that the American government also sent military-grade weapons to the Sinaloa cartel. According to the latest revelations, it was these weapons which were part of the Fast and Furious scandal. Automatic firearms, which disappeared during that operation, led by Eric Holder, were used to kill U.S. border agents. This latest evidence and testimony points towards a massive scandal involving both Republican and Democratic administrations. At the very best, this provides the best evidence so far that the federal government was sponsoring the smuggling of billions of dollars of cocaine into the United States. Worse still, weapons purchased for the United States military have been sent to the cartel and used to kill American agents. Those actions transcend any party politics, and the jury's still out. We'll follow the story and bring you the latest.
Well, Chapo Guzman, the head of the Sinaloa cartel, is behind bars probably for life. Do you think anybody from the cartel will step forward and play Who Wants to Be a Billionaire? This is Dean Becker, DrugTruth.net.